everybody. Welcome to the last episode of season one of Women Seekers and Leaders. I'm your host, Serena Gentilina, and I'm delighted to share this podcast with you, where every week we highlight amazing women in the pursuit of truth. These women inspire us to look beyond the known into the unknown and to see what can't yet be seen. Today we have a special host, executive producer at Yoga International, Emily Smith, and she'll be speaking with esteemed yoga teacher and author, Christina Sell. Christina is the author of several books, including My Body is a Temple, Yoga as a Path to Wholeness. In this episode, Christina and Emily speak candidly about her path from addiction recovery to yoga, the struggles and relapses she experienced along the way, and yoga as a redemptive practice. She also reflects on how self-improvement practices can potentially inhibit us from our deeper self-worth, culturally conditioned ideas of selfhood, the thorny issues around the marketing of yoga, social media's positive and negative impact on body image, and more.
Hi everyone, I'm Emily, and I have the pleasure of being here today with Christina Sell to talk a little bit about her path. Thank you so much for joining me, Christina.
Thanks for having me here. It's great to be with you.
Absolutely. So I thought we'd dive right in, and I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about your path maneuvering through the world of spirituality, yoga, and religion. I know we were talking before, and you mentioned you were raised Methodist. Do you mind starting there?
Oh, it's a good place to start. Yes, my parents are both very active. Well, they were active in the Methodist Church. I say were. My mom passed about a year ago. In fact, we were speaking about that. She passed exactly a year ago. And you asked me about my own background in the Methodist Church, but in some ways it probably starts with her background in the Methodist Church. She grew up in the Methodist Church with her family, and she spent the first 5 or 6 years of her life with her grandparents. And they lived in this big house in a small town in Georgia called Livonia, Georgia. And their big house was right across from the Livonia United Methodist Church, where her grandparents were founding members. And so in those first 5 or 6 years she spent with her grandparents, she would go to church meetings, not just the Sunday service, but the women's circles and the Sunday schools and all of the different events that were part of the church in small town rural Georgia. Years later, when she came to live with us in the last few years of her life, she and I would go to Bible study at the Methodist Church together. And she one day told me that she spent her whole life in women's Bible studies, and I look back on her involvement in the church. She was always doing something of service in the church. She was very active, from typing the newsletters to teaching Sunday school to just always being a steady presence in whatever church community that she was part of. And she and my father met in a Methodist college in LaGrange, Georgia, which was my dad's hometown. And so they really had a bond that they shared in terms of a deep religious faith, not just a religious faith. Like, there were no pictures in our house of Jesus, and it wasn't a super churchy household, but the church was a real part of our life and a real part of their life. So I think that roots in spiritual community, I could really trace back to what I witnessed, how my parents lived, and then the stories that I've heard about how they lived before, you know, they were married and before the kids came along, my sister and myself. So I feel fortunate in terms of my background in Christianity that it was a fairly benevolent experience to be part of the church. I think for me, there's certain things that I grew up feeling in the presence of a lot of the teachings that they were describing. I always felt a kind of relationship with Jesus and as a good thing. And while certainly I think there's been things I've had to unravel spiritually about some of the Old Testament punishing God notions and heaven and hell and some of those paradigms that come from that tradition, in general, I haven't been encumbered by some of the heavy-duty fire and brimstone messages that can come along with Christianity. So, and I would also say that the importance of a spiritual community and being around people whose faith is active and where that's expressed in whether it's gathering for a meal and stopping to say the blessing or praying for one another or just the acknowledgement that the life on the surface that we're all sharing and all of the social things and the work relationships and obligations, all of that's referenced in something deeper. That's something I just grew up immersed in, and I express that in my own life now, probably different than my parents for sure, you know, but they modeled that in their way, and I think that comes pretty naturally to me and has. I think for me, some of the issues with Christianity that I faced weren't so much that I didn't believe in God, it wasn't so much that I had a problem with Jesus, some of those teachings, but more that sitting and listening to a sermon didn't really help me. So, for instance, as a teenager, you know, I had troubles with an eating disorder and substance abuse, and didn't really help me to go to church and say, here, don't sin, or don't be judgmental, or love your brother as yourself, or whatever. I would have if I could have. I just couldn't. So I remember just being in the throes of my eating disorder, and if I could have just stopped, I would have just stopped. You know, if it had been a matter of I could just pray my way out of that, I would have. And so for me, it wasn't so much that the paradigm was problematic or so hellfire and brimstone that I couldn't manage it. It's more that it was incomplete in terms of the technology it offered me. And I think also for me, too, I just come by a sense of being ecumenical pretty naturally, meaning even as a kid, and I loved so many of the teachings of Jesus, and I really felt a deep personal relationship with that tradition. And I also loved Eastern spirituality from the first time I heard about it, and I never really understood how that one way could be only one way. And so that's just not... it's okay for me that it is that way for other people. It's just a little bit for me. I've always joked that, oh, yeah, I'd be such a good Christian if it was just for that one point about the only way part. And as I've grown, I come to understand that there is a way that for some people it really is the only way, and that makes perfect sense. But for me, I see those teachings of universal love and the teachings of what it is to move beyond our patterned thinking. I see that in yoga, and I see that in Christianity, and I see it in the teachings of Buddhism, and so I'm much more interested in all the places where those teachings can be found than in funneling myself or trying to force myself to believe something that just doesn't come so naturally to me.
Yeah. So you talked a little bit about the technologies that were maybe missing from Christianity for you. Like, how did you move into different technologies or modalities like yoga or other therapies and practices?
Well, for me, so much of my, I think, adult spirituality has been informed by recovering from an eating disorder. And I always laugh that I would be in high school, if you'd say, you know, what would you be voted for in the yearbook or something? It would be least likely to become a yoga teacher. You know, so I kind of say I do this because... I needed it, not because I was so suited for it. I think there are people very well suited to the yogic life. You know, they're naturally introverted and quiet, and sort of ready for all kinds of austerities and things. I've met people like that. It come very naturally to them. For me, I came by those things because I really needed them. So my life was out of control because I was so at odds with myself and the world. And so much of what I came to explore was really following the path of necessity along the way. When I was about 18, I was in therapy, and I was really bottoming out between bulimia and acting out with drugs and alcohol and boys, and I was pretty miserable and kind of spinning out of control. And I was at my psychiatrist's office at the time, and I was at close to the bottom, and I just said how miserable I was and how I really wanted help. And she just kind of dropped everything and looked at me and said, well, what would that help look like? And I said, I would be with people who had problems also in a way that we could talk about them. And I spelled out what exactly I thought I needed. And she found a program for me, a residential treatment program in California that was almost to the T exactly what I described. And to me, it's kind of a miraculous story in a sense, because I was a train wreck at the time. I mean, I don't think I had many coherent thoughts through many of my days at the time, and yet some part of me really knew and could describe in words and paint a picture of it, in a sense, what would help me.
Yeah.
I was talking to a friend of mine who's in the Jewish faith, and she said that her rabbi recently was talking about that very thing, that when we, in the Old Testament, for instance, they would talk about hearing the voice of God. And the question that her rabbi posed was, how is it that we think we would hear the voice of God? And how many times have we gotten direction from ourselves or intuitive knowings or this sense that this would be right? And then, in a sense, be willing, not just to ourselves, but to our communities, to claim that as the very voice of God. Mm-hmm. And so all the things really from there kind of follow, because that was such a unique program that I went to at that time. It wasn't medical model. It wasn't even traditional 12-step recovery model. It was kind of this throwback from some of these programs like EST and Landmark Forum, but even before that, in the 70s with the Synanon program. So the founders of this program had their roots in kind of deep experiential therapies from the human potential movement, and then applied them to a residential program for teenagers. And so during that 18 months, you know, we had tons of very confrontational group therapies. We had wilderness excursions. We did all kinds of cathartic work, like banging on pillows and empty chair work and any, you name it, any kind of human potential sort of therapy that there was to do, we were doing, and it helped. And my life kind of started a deeper, more consciously deeper movement there. Then I was introduced to 12-step communities, and then that was also in the early 90s, late 80s, so there was a kind of movement with all of the New Age stuff. People were talking about crystals, and of course this program was in California, so it's all kind of natural like that. And after that, I went to a liberal arts college in Arizona and called Prescott College. And that town had deeply conservative kind of Bible-thumping community, but then right alongside it was this liberal arts, kind of very hippie liberal type place with an outdoor education and experiential educational component. And so it was very easy to pull on the thread of mysticism and pull on the thread of spirituality and explore different avenues for self-understanding then. And so it's always kind of curious to me as people say, how did you get into it? And I almost always want to answer back, like, how did you not? You know? So, and one of the times later in life, I met a man who became my spiritual teacher. His name's Lee Lazowick, and he and I were talking one time, and I was talking a little bit about this story. And he said, well, the thing is, if you hadn't gotten into that program and you'd followed the course of your life the way it was going, chances are you'd have ended up in jail and probably found the Dharmic teachings with someone bringing meditation into jail. I was like, well, that's a cheery thought. And he went on to say that this fourth way teacher, this Armenian mystic who developed the fourth way school, Gurdjieff, used to talk about, if you're meant for the work, so to speak, you're meant for a life of spiritual exploration and understanding, you will find it wherever you go. And if you're not meant for it, you'll live around people doing it, and you won't hardly even notice. And, you know, that's a little cosmic and big picture, but he was a spiritual teacher. He was the guru. So I say that to say that I think I must have been meant for it. And I could look further back into my deep childhood, and I remember being about 9 years old, and my parents were at church doing something, and I remember playing with the church, the preacher's kids out in the yard in the church at night, and lying down on the ground and looking up at the stars, you know, and it wasn't an issue for me that I didn't believe that there was more. I just had this feeling as a kid, you know, call it my 9-year-old existential crisis, like at 9 going, I think there is a God, but does God know that I'm here? You know, this feeling of really feeling the something more, but not feeling seen, heard, or known by that. And so I'd say, I think that that's a theme. You know, I could say my parents, I could trace that back like I did from my parents in church, but even my own 9-year-old stargazing and feeling into something and longing to not just know it, but to be known by it. And so I think my teacher's kind of sentiment that if you're destined for it, you'll find it, and if you're not, you won't. It's been a very natural unfolding of following interests and opportunities, but also spurred all along, because without those connections for me, I just didn't do that well in life. I just am not someone who does well as a non-believer. You know, so I think I have friends and students who are atheists and or agnostics, and it really is fine for them. They seem super happy. But in those moments for me, when I'm kind of in the spiritual dark night of the soul, and my doubt is high, or my connection is dim, I'm not the same me. So I kind of think sometimes I sit down next to my very smart, intellectual, atheistic friends. I'm like, they've got a much better case than I do. Intellectually, I think you might even be right. But it doesn't concern me so much, because I'm just someone who relies on prayer and relies on those kinds of considerations to fill in the rest of my life. So at some point, stop being as important to me whether I had all the right answers, and started to realize, oh yeah, these are places of strength for me, and that help me grow into who I am more, instead of following the thread of maybe habits or conditioning. And that sounds sort of dry, but for me, you know, I could have died, you know, vomiting with my head in a toilet, or drunk driving, or some very other risky behavior that I was involved in. So to me, it was some kind of spiritual connection or die. And that served me well for a while. That's not how I live with it now. Like, meditate or die. It's not like that for me now. Now it's got its own life and its own value, but it all kind of goes back to that for me.
Yeah. And so after integrating and exploring so many different spiritual paths, traditions, teachings, therapies, how did you end up settling into the practice of yoga, and why do you feel called to share that with other people?
I was a philosophy mentor over the years, and he will talk a lot about how certain practices in yoga are masculine encoded and certain practices are feminine encoded, meaning there's a whole bunch of practices that are very directive. You make a plan, you follow the prescription. It's much more in that kind of, not male-female, but masculine-feminine. There's like, and even down to, you see it in our common sort of self-improvement lives now. Set a goal, make an intention, make a plan, make it measurable. All that kind of super prescriptive, very focused, kind of driving forward type of work. And then there's the feminine code, let go, let God, trust the universe, follow your bliss. and usually wives that seem to function well have some of both. But I have lived my life for, as you said the other day, practical as I am, and I kind of have this orderly way about me. The way I have lived into my life has really been more feminine encoded without a lot of planning. And so it's been following a thread as it's unfolded, and then applying my efforts to what's unfolding. I'm not very good at writing down a goal and three manageable action steps and getting it into my day planner. I'm sort of organized by nature, but I don't live my life with a big goal-setting agenda. I don't mind that people do. I think it's really cool. I just haven't done it that way. So that's my preface, that yoga's stuck. I got into it just very accidentally. I was traveling down the coast of Oregon to Northern California and pulled off the road to have lunch at this intentional community and massage school, hoping to go to massage school at the time. I was in my, like, I don't know, 21 or 22, right out of college. And they offered me a job, and I took it. And I was in the middle of a breakup. And so, you know, that first adult breakup where I thought we were going to get married, and then he broke up with me, and had to leave town, pack all my things. Very dramatic.
Something dramatic.
Something big. Like something big. And not risk seeing him in the coffee shop, you know, that kind of thing. So, and anyway, I was there, and there's a Iyengar yoga teacher on the faculty there. And she sat down with the new kid at lunch and said, "You should come to my yoga class." And I said, "Okay." She was a great Iyengar yoga teacher. And I said, "Well, when is it? Where is it?" She says, "It's 6:30 in the morning in the barn." And I thought, okay. So I did. I got up, and walked up to the barn and did yoga. Now, going back to my mom, she used to do yoga in the 70s in our living room on this quilt with Richard Hillman's book. I don't know if you've ever seen that. It's called, like, Richard Hillman had this book, like, 28-Day Yoga Challenge or something like that, with a woman in a red tights and a red leotard, you know, old school hippie kind of look. And my mom used to do that every night after dinner. And I remember doing yoga with her as a little kid like that. Not seriously, but just rolling around on the floor with her. So anyway, I just kind of stumbled into yoga, and it wasn't an all-at-once thing. For me, it was, I remember, I liked it. I liked her approach. I liked learning. I loved how I felt afterwards. Mm-hmm. I remember very distinctly coming down the hill from that barn to breakfast, and I just felt good in my body. And I was really, you know, coming off a relapse with bulimia and in my first few years of recovery, and feeling good in my body after yoga was amazing. And it was this sort of feeling of aliveness. You know, there was no mirrors, there's no pounding music, it wasn't a workout. I'd had all kinds of, you know, done sports and gymnastics and cheerleading. So it wasn't being in my body and being competent in my body that was new. It was this feeling of goodness, this intrinsic goodness. And it just kind of stayed with me. And in those days, there wasn't yoga everywhere. And even at that school, I liked it. So I went regularly. And then I said to Gaina, who is the teacher, I said, I'd like to do more yoga more often. And she goes, well, get these books. And she handed me Yoga for Runners and Stretch and Relax by Maxine Tobias. These were two Iyengar teachers who'd written books at the time. And she says, so practice. And I thought she'd invite me to some of her other classes, but they weren't the beginning level classes. And so one of the things I'm so grateful about with that is that from the beginning, it was very clear that if I wanted a yoga practice, I was going to have to practice. I wasn't going to be able to do it 5 days, 7 days a week in class. I was going to have to establish a practice on my own. And so I used the books and I did that. And I did some yoga during that time. And it just kind of stuck with me, and I would always return to it. But I also went back into triathloning and sports and bodybuilding. And so it wasn't like, and yoga, and then forevermore.
Yeah.
When I was about 18 and I was in that treatment center, I taught aerobics, which is a whole other story. And I was a fitness teacher from about the time I was 18 until I was 28, so off and on, 10 years of teaching things in fitness, and then in the midst of that, I discovered yoga. So I never really thought much about teaching yoga. My teachers were so smart and so knowledgeable and so experienced. I never looked at them and thought I could do what they did. It just seemed like, oh, I can teach an aerobics class, but I can't go teach the way that these people teach. So I practiced occasionally, and sometimes less, sometimes more. And then around 98, I got more seriously into it. And again, a little bit after doing some bodybuilding and having a big bulimia relapse. So again, the eating disorder struggles, they weren't, and then my whole life changed either. I've had such a circuitous kind of journey. You used that word earlier. So I kind of wish sometimes I had a story that said, and then this happened, and then I was forever fixed. And it really hasn't been like that. It's been more of like that kind of cyclical, spiraling journey of revisiting things. And the challenge, I think for me, as I've grown more conscious, and then that spiral returns to a place of dysfunction, let's say, or pain, it's excruciating, because now I would be more awake and aware when I revisit the pattern.
Yeah.
And it's so excruciating. And this isn't something I hear people talk that much about. So I make it a point in my teaching to talk about things my teachers weren't talking about, because I in case someone out there is knows better and finds themselves back in the same hole. And it's worse than ever, because you're not as numb. And no more.
And it's like you felt the can of worms.
And yeah, and you felt the freedom. Yeah. And so the constriction is so much more painful. Mm-hmm. And so I went back into yoga, and I more steadily. And one of the things about not just yoga, but asana, more steadily throughout that whole time, you know, I've was in meditation and in different therapy groups and 12-step groups. So to me, they all kind of go together, the ways that asana and spiritual inquiry, and they always sort of sit alongside one another. But asana as a specifically physical practice for someone who had compulsive exercise issues and compulsive eating issues had this great way of blending self-inquiry and philosophy with physicality. It's also got a shadow element because it does that. Yeah. But unlike being in a health club on a treadmill, just thinking calories to get physicality, you know, exercised, so to speak, asana didn't seem to trigger that same eating disordered thinking in the same way. And that's not the case for everybody, clearly. Especially, I think now there's so much more blend between the worlds of fitness and the worlds of asana and the ways that it's expressed, that I do think people's body image issues and exercise compulsions and eating disordered patterns can get as triggered in an asana class now as they would going to a health club, if not more so. Mm-hmm. For me, the way that asana was practiced kind of, and I was introduced to it, was no mirrors, no loud music, no workout-y emphasis. It was much slower, a little bit more alternative culture. And that was useful for me as an exercise practice because it was an exercise practice that didn't trigger as much of the compulsivity as other exercises did for me at the time. This is a long, circuitous answer to getting into teaching yoga. So, you know, I had started and was introduced to it in 91. I practiced intermittently. We're now 98. Throughout that time, I taught fitness. And a friend of mine opened a yoga studio in Arizona right next door to our coffee shop. And she asked me to teach yoga. And I said, okay, I guess. All right. And so, again, I had no designs on being a yoga teacher. I was invited to do it. At the time, I was studying Iyengar yoga, and my teacher at the Manuso Manos was doing a workshop in Tucson, Arizona, and I was in Prescott, Arizona, so I drove down to this workshop to work with him. And I said to him, you know, when I was out of college and I had studied counseling, they gave me this job to counsel kids and their families. And he's looking at me like, uh-huh. And I said, and now I think it's insane that they entrusted me at 22 with children's lives and to give advice to their parents about parenting. And he's like, uh-huh. And I said, so I kind of feel like I just got asked to teach yoga. And 5 or 10 years from now, if I say yes, I'm going to look back on teaching yoga the same way I'm looking back at being a counselor at 22. Like, I had no business teaching yoga. What was I thinking? And he's just listening, kind of smiling patiently for me to finish my story. And he says, yeah, but that's no problem. And I said, really? And he said, yeah, look, everybody teaches before they're ready. That's the way it works. He says, it's like parenting. You don't get ready and then you have kids. You have kids and you learn how to be a parent as you go. And then, you know, he's a very strong personality guy. And he said, and so then his kind of booming voice, and he said, and besides which, who in that small bodunk town that you live in knows more about yoga than you, you know? Which I think really meant who in that small town you live in studies with him. I don't think it was as much like a testimony of his confidence in me as much as you're my student and therefore you know more than probably anyone in your town, which isn't exactly true, but it was a good, you know, it was very in character for him, a sweet moment. And he says, here's what you have to remember. You have to remember that everybody starts too soon. He says, in the beginning, don't teach poses you can't do. Certainly don't teach poses you don't practice. And he says, and make sure you always have a teacher who's senior to you who you can ask questions of. And that was his blessing, basically, to teach. And so to me, that's kind of how the whole thing in a lot of ways has unfolded, that, you know, and that's been the advice I've gotten from my mentors and teachers is, you know, wait for the universe to invite you. Mm-hmm. And so this woman, Kelly Gray, who had the studio, a friend of mine, she invited me to teach. my teacher gave me a blessing to teach, basically, in his unique way. And I follow the thread of teaching yoga, and opportunities have presented themselves to me, which I do my best to say yes to, as many opportunities as I can. And so I think the thing that keeps me interested in it is that I studied counseling, and I studied my master's degree is in education. I have a whole host of experiences physically in terms of exercise, both positive and negative aspects of it. And I have my existential longing from as my other theme. And there's just this way that yoga and then teaching yoga, it has all of it for me. I have the great fortune to have opportunities to teach outside of the public classroom. The day-in, day-out life of a public classroom is one of the, I think, greatest gifts being given to humanity right now, that there are places in the hustle and bustle of life that people can go for anywhere from, depending on your Groupon and your class package out there, from practically free to maybe... I mean, I did pay $45 in Singapore for a drop-in yoga class, which did seem steep to me, but that's an expensive place. So anyway, that's at the far end of the range from free to extreme. But I, but for a reasonable fee is a place you can drop out of some of the cultural madness and step into movement and breath and reminders of the teachings. And that's what I mean by that's a great gift to humanity, even though there's problems. And so there's people in studios day in, day out, ushering people through that process and holding space for the process should not ever be overlooked. You know, and so much of really the bread and butter of teaching yoga happens in that format, and now it's expanded into platforms like Yoga International and online, and the whole thing is just, but so much of any of it, the way it's expanded and grown, can all be traced back to those rooms that offer sanctuary in the midst of madness. So we really want to make sure to shout out for the importance of that. And the more that that has become popular and the more that it has become mainstream, that gives all of us yoga teachers and teacher trainees, trainers jobs, and that's a good thing. But also sometimes certain things get diluted, or what people perceive that they can address in an hour long or hour and a half long class. Sometimes over the long haul, that can feel kind of limited. I don't think it ultimately is, but I think the narrative in the public class can sometimes feel smaller than all that's possible through yoga. And I say that to recognize I have the opportunity to speak to larger issues a lot, like opportunities where people are willing to sit down with a microphone between us and talk in times like this, or in trainings, and teacher trainings and teacher development programs. So one of the things I like about that is it puts to use my curriculum design background. I get to design programs and how they fit together. I also work closely with students over a long period of time, and so I don't do counseling with them, but the interpersonal dynamics of I learned in psychotherapy training and counseling come into play. My love of relationship and understanding how important that is, that's there in teaching yoga. I love the body, and I find anatomy fascinating, but I wouldn't want to do PT because I like all the other stuff, and I could kind of go on. I love philosophy and religion, and you can just push, you know, like open one door within yoga and spend a lifetime on any one stream of philosophy. So if my physical practice gets a little bit dry, I might dive into philosophical studies. If my philosophy study starts to feel too esoteric, well, the whole human dimension is explorable in yoga. And if I'm sometimes not interested in my own practice, my students and what's happening with them is inspiring, and sometimes their enthusiasm for practice brings me back to mine. So it's just never been a thing in terms of teaching yoga. It's never been a thing that's dried up for me. And I'm not always interested in the same thing, but there's always something that keeps me interested and keeps me going and gives me a way, you know, in a sense. I feel like the act of teaching yoga for me is redemptive. I don't mean like heaven and hell redemption. I don't mean that from necessarily the old Christian paradigm, but I mean it from when I said I'd be the least likely to teach yoga, and that I was so lost from myself, that all of that, however, is part of teaching yoga. You know, all the ways I'm lost and come back, and the ways that I find myself, it's like it's a way to make use of that, you know, to understand like, oh, wow, I had sexual abuse in my background and know what it's like to have an eating disorder and know what it's like to act out and to relapse and then to come back. And how many of us don't go through that in yoga practice? You know, the ways we're on and off our wagon of whether it's the practice or our other lifestyle choices. And so it makes a way for all that trouble, if you will, and suffering and difficulty to be made into something good. And that's what I mean by redemptive. It makes use of that. And there's this great line in the Kalarnava Tantra, and it says on the path of yoga, it says your enjoyment can become, my teacher was saying it's a verb form of yoga, that boga, yogas. It's like saying yoga in verb form. And it's a tantric text, so it's really describing that turn away from renunciation and away from liberation outside the body, but it's describing the path of liberation in the body and through the body. And it says on this path, they call it the path of the kula, on this path the enjoyment can become yoga, it yogas, and sin becomes art, and all life is liberation. And it's the vision that's possible in that viewpoint. And it's a radical turn in yoga philosophy, but it's the one that's very helpful to me to consider. And this idea that sin, and not sin as like you've made these mistakes and you're going to burn in eternal hell sin, but sin in that way that, you know, it's an archery term. Like, so if you aim at a target and the bullseye is what you're aiming for and you miss it, then they would say, well, you sinned by 5 inches or you sinned by 3 inches. And it's not sin like you're good or you're bad sin, but like you've missed the mark, and you might have missed the mark a lot or you might have missed the mark a little, but that sin or those ways that we've missed the mark of our true nature, of that bullseye point, if you will, you know, mm-hmm. like it can be made into art and it could be made useful to me. It can be made beautiful. And so I think there's so much in yoga that just keeps showing me ways to do that. I make a lot of mistakes. But a lot of times people, when they've made a mistake, they call me up. Or remember when I had a relapse, and believe me, that was awful way back when. And I didn't call up the person who'd been in recovery awesomely, actively, abstinent for the last 10 years. I called the last person in my 12-step group who relapsed. Because she was closest to it, and I knew she'd be the least likely to judge. You know, so I just think about that sin being made into art, into arts, being made useful like that. So
yeah, well, that touches on something that we talked about a little bit before, but this idea of, you know, like big S self versus like little S self, and how yoga can be like a process of uncovering and discovering and liberating, but at some point can be co-opted to be like a never-ending self-improvement project. So for you, you know, where is that line, and like how do you walk this path of growth, but also without, I guess, thinking that there's like an end point that will be ultimately achieved?
Right. I think for me, you know, I think you're right. Like that idea that up to a point, self-improvement is really important. And after a point, it's kind of problematic.
Yeah.
I read something, so I don't remember the name, I wish I did, of the Buddhist teacher who said this, but it was to the effect that you're all way more enlightened than you know, like way more beautiful than you could ever imagine, way more holy, way more amazing. I'm definitely paraphrasing now that you say it that way. But then, you know, so, and that just kind of points to that paradox of the whole thing, is that we're both, you know, we have so much to improve upon. And so much that's really fine as it is. And so I think in terms of the yoga philosophy as I understand it today, that self, you can't really improve upon the self, because, you know, the self and the soul and the spirit and like that is already fine, already fixed, already whole, can't be broken, can't be born, it can't die. Those are big, lofty teachings. But it's good to consider, I think, you know. So even some of those new age notions of like soul retrieval or soul healing, and even the way, you know, we might talk about that just commonly, fixed my soul. But the soul's a need fixing. You know, that's the premise from the yoga philosophy, as I understand it. Doesn't need chicken soup.
Good to know.
Now our psychology and our personalities, you know, they're broken and fractured as well as beautiful and pristine as well, you know. So from the perspective of wholeness, you know, that deep wholeness of self is eternal, stainless, pure, whatever word you want to say. But then we're in these packages where we're refracted, I believe, forms of that, condensed, contracted forms of that, you know, ever-present nature. And there's plenty of work to do on the psychology. And at the same time, you know, not swearing, for instance, or eating perfectly, or all of those things that are self-improvement topics, which are all, you know, really wonderful, they don't necessarily, touch the soul. But they do affect our capacity to feel, glimpse, and reside in the understanding of who we really are. So I think those are really separate and related domains. Like, no matter how much self-improvement I do, there's a place that's unaffected by it. And yet, at the same time, when I am in my dysfunctional patterns, I'm not necessarily got access to that. And so we're really looking at not a purity paradigm of making myself so pure that I finally deserve God and finally deserve the self and have earned it, but I'm really clearing a pathway for access. And what people need for access is different at different times in their lives. I mean, that's kind of metaphysical, but, you know, for instance, I watch it in eating disordered thinking. You know, I might wake up, feel scared, and decide to think I need to lose 5 pounds. That is not going to solve fear, you know, but it might keep me occupied and distracted from my existential fear and anxieties. And in that way, the self-improvement plan becomes a bit of a distraction. And then there's also personalities. You know, this is a point my teacher leaves to talk a lot about the difference between what it is to grow and mature as a person and have a well-functioning personality that causes as few problems as possible in life. You know, it's kind of like good practical thinking here. Best way not to be hungover is not to drink too much. You know, there's so much self-improvement that just wipes off a ton of drama out of our life once we're established in it, because we're not creating our own suffering. And there's a lot of suffering we can diminish by getting out of unconscious dysfunctional patterns. So self-improvement is certainly useful. There's so many things around wholesome diet and lifestyle choices that directly affect our health and our well-being. Mm-hmm. And but that's really different than being worthy of knowing the truth of who we are. Yeah. And it's a really different thing to make. And for a lot of us that I know, those are tangled up. And so there's this, I think we're always going to be, probably many of us, teasing those tangles out, because I think so much of the way many of us are indoctrinated culturally into religion and into spirituality, there's so much purity paradigm behind it. There's so much worthiness, and you earn it and you have to deserve it and all of those things, that it's very hard not to take some of that on, even if your intellect knows better. I mean, it's been hard for me not to take that on. So to me, I think about what it is to access that place of the deepest wholeness. And one of the points that Lee would make a lot in his teaching was that we have a personality. You know, whether that personality is sarcastic, funny, serious. And there's, up to a point, important work to refine some of that so we cause less harm. But not endlessly, because all of that is just our personality. And it's not that at the end of perfecting our personality, we get the self. Mm-hmm. It's not that. I don't believe that at the end of making myself to some perfect person who never swears, never makes mistakes, always eats the right thing, drives a speed limit, you know, I don't know, whatever it is, you know, it's not at the end of all of that I will arrive at the capital S self. I'll just arrive as a mature, somewhat neurotic person. and yet along the way of that process of self-refinement, I do think there's these practices where we can tap into the glimpses of the greater self, those places of wholeness. And, you know, for me, meditation's a real tool for that. Mantra's been a real tool for that. And asana's a tool for that. And asana can be incredibly distracting because there's so much to perfect and refine endlessly. But it's not that the clasp in Reiki Asana 4 at the end of that clasp is enlightenment. It's just perhaps a rotator cuff tear or another pose. I mean, it's not that they're all leading to that. To me, it's something really quite different. And I think that it's natural that we spend time on the path pursuing these things with the belief that, oh, at the end of this, I'm going to get something. And it's not until after a period of time when that has proven itself not to be true that something else emerges. Even though intellectually, for instance, I knew these things at 30, I'm almost 50 now, and I know them differently. And I expect the same things that I'm saying now when I'm 60 will still be true, but will be true with greater depth and understanding, and some new things will also be true, and I'll have rethought a handful of things as well. So I think that there's just nothing like the time put in on the path, and that's also my understanding, really, of some of our longevity practices from Ayurveda and from the health-based practices of the yoga tradition. They weren't like get healthy for healthy's sake because healthy is the goal. It's like get healthy so that you can prolong your life so that you have more time to grow and to mature. Mm-hmm. And one of my favorite teachings about that came from a lecture I was in with Dr. Robert Sobota, a really great, preeminent teacher on Ayurveda and spiritual practice. And he was talking about, and I'm paraphrasing, and mistakes of understanding are definitely mine, not his, so I'm going to take responsibility for that. He's really a quite amazing teacher. And he was talking about how when we are about 35, we're at our physical peak in terms of our body's capacity to regenerate, our physical recovery speeds and capacities. Now, that might not be true in everybody's case, but just at a very physical level, that's a real peak for the physical structure. And at that point, we will begin the process of aging in a different way. Our systems slow down in terms of recovery. Metabolism is going to be changing. Collagen changes. All of these things change in the body. And he says, you know, lifestyle protocols are, in a sense, controlling that downhill momentum. You can make the road longer through health and practices. So you can make the slant of the downhill less extreme.
Less bumpy,
you know. And so instead of throwing yourself off the cliff of aging, you can make it a nice gradual ramp with lifestyle choices. However, the interesting thing is that at 35, you're at the beginning of your capacity for introspection, for creative imagination, for visualization, for your psychic powers, in a sense, and for your interior life is really at its more low point. And we think about that from the traditional teachings in India. You would have been like becoming into your work life and family life and just kind of making your way in the world. And a lot of that requires less introspection than the later years, those forest years they describe in the Indian tradition. And so he was saying, though, that the point of those health and yoga practices for longevity and were to extend the lifespan, not just for the sake of longevity itself, not because youth was prized, but because more time that you had physically in a body gave you more time to deepen your insight, to deepen your understanding, to grow your capacity for introspection, to meditate, to expand your inner life. And he says, ideally, the yogic path of growing old, so to speak, is to slow the inevitable decline of the body so that you have more time, and that at the end, as your body's declining, you're at the height, at the peak of your mental, emotional, spiritual power, so to speak. And then that is really the yogic death, that the body drops in the light of the spirit. And so those two things are really, to me, so informative of a pathway that nothing like experience teaches us the teaching. And that this type of work is, you know, like, how do we do it? Well, we do it. That was kind of your question. How do you live with those paradoxes of little self, big self? How do we improve ourselves without being distracted by it, without making it just more cause for self-hatred and self-criticism? How is it that we see that we're limited and unlimited? How is it that we do? Well, we do it by doing it, really, in a sense, and allowing the process of practice to, I think, teach us as we go. And that sounds sort of like, I would have hated that answer when I was 22. I'd be like, I'm going to get this thing. I'm going to put my foot behind my head. I'm going to balance on my hands, touch my toes. I'm going to do these poses. I'm going to get my my shit together. I was very disappointed by people, you know, like me at 50 who seemed to still have so many problems, you know. I was like pretty sure by the time I was 50, I'd really have it handled. And now I just am a little bit more honest, I think, about myself, but I'm more loving about the messiness of it. So, I mean, to me, we have to look at what's causing harm. You know, and there's a lot of things. When I went to India for the first time, and I just saw it's a hustling, bustling, dynamic culture of like loud talking, loud noises. No one stands on line. Rules of politeness are not Western rules of politeness. And I realized I had wrapped all these personality ideals of like what it means to be a good yogi. We're all wrapped up with Western cultural paradigms of being a good person. And that became synonymous for me for being yogic. And when I went to India, the motherland of the yoga tradition, they had a completely different cultural paradigm of what good behavior is. And then I have to start to think about, well, what does it mean then to see how much of my cultural meanings I've transposed on what it means to be yogic, and to start to say, oh, you know, the yogic path is one of consciousness and coming to know myself in that way, not just becoming a more polite, better, like more hygienic version of myself, but like, oh, who am I really outside of those culturally conditioned ideals? And when I was in India studying asana one year, we were talking about these things in a philosophy session with one of the teachers, and we were talking about the capital S self and the lower S self, and he was much more old school paradigm, like the senses, you have to move beyond the senses, and some of that good Patanjali Yoga Sutra teachings, and really great stuff. And he was talking about how yoga is not a sensual process, and that asana is not about feeling good in your body. It's about understanding who you are. He was going through this whole thing. And then one of the people in the class raises their hand and says, yeah, I get you, Rajiv, what you're saying philosophically. Like, there was a chart on the board. There was, like, the structures of the koshas, you know, the whole thing. And so we're like, I gotcha. And he goes, but my problem with what you're saying is when I do asana, I feel good. And you're saying it's not about feeling good, but I do it because it helps me feel good. And I always feel good when I'm done. And Rajiv looked at him and he goes, yes, but what you have to recognize is the feeling good that you're describing is because your personality has receded and you're closer to yourself. And he says, that's what we're after. He goes, the nature of the self, when you're close to it, will show itself as a feeling of feeling good. And that's really different than the feeling good of getting a massage or just eating something that we like, which are, I mean, to me, I'm a sensual creature. We've been talking about astrology in some of our filming this week. You know, I'm like, in Western astrology, I have a sun sign in Taurus. So it's like, I got like an earthy, sensual, like good food, like drink, like massage, like a feeling of wind on my face. I love the whole life of the senses. And making a distinction between what feels good there, and I think that's a really healthy thing, to be able to enjoy our bodies, our senses, participate in the world fully. So I'm not a yogi who has a problem with that. I'm a yogi who says, and what else? So in addition to being able to feel good in my body and to feel good in my world of the senses, is there something else I can come to know also? And instead of putting those things at odds with one another, that to me is that meaning of all life being liberation, as in we're not just drop the body for liberation. We're saying, oh, well, and what else is there? And so that feeling of goodness after asana, you know, we get up, shavasana, and we get up, and we're like, oh, even if it's a moment, to me, those are the glimpses of the self. Even meditation, I might sit, and most of the time it feels like I'm just listening to my mind go crazy and get back to the mantra or get back to the breath or whatever the technique it is. But then there are those times where our consciousness around time changes, where 20 minutes doesn't feel like 2 hours, or where we get up, and even if it felt like a maniacal experience of mechanical thinking the whole time, I get up and something different has happened. Or what I've come to see is that it's not so much any one time on my cushion or any one time in an asana session, but to go, oh, wow, over 20 years, regular visits to that place of goodness have accumulated something that is a source of strength, that is a source of knowing, and it's not any one workshop or any one session. but it's what happens over time.
Yeah, and now you're talking about obviously like practice over a long duration. So obviously sometimes we're like, ah, oh, that felt good. You know, my meditation went quote unquote great.
Yeah.
It was just
I'm knocking this out of the park.
Yeah. And then there are other times when it's like a long expanse of it feels really bad.
Yeah.
I don't want to practice. You mentioned the phrase, a dark night of the soul. And so do you experience those periods of doubt or an absence of pleasure or good response from practice, and what keeps you going?
Yeah, I definitely do. And I think anyone who talks about practice who's not talking about why we don't want to practice is not giving you the adequate picture. And so I think a huge thing to start to understand is all of the reasons why we don't want to practice. You know, and they're different for some of us, you know. So some I can think of a zillion reasons not to practice, whether it's a formal practice, you know, like roll out my mat or sit on my cushion, or even the practice of offering myself care, you know, and just offering myself my own awareness. Anyone who's trying to teach you about practice who's also not talking about not wanting to practice, to me, is not giving the full picture. And maybe people, like I said, some people just are naturals. Back to Patanjali a little bit, when he talks about things, he uses this word a lot in those sutras. He talks about being established in practice. Even when you get to the section on the yamas and the niyamas, he talks about what happens when you're established in any one of those principles. So he like says, this is what ahimsa is. And he says, when the sadhaka is established in ahimsa, then, you know, in non-harming, then others abandon hostility in their presence. And each of the yamas has this promise of what happens when you're established in it. And I think that's a really interesting inquiry around practice, is to know ourselves and say, am I established yet or am I not? And a lot of us are very perfectionistically oriented, and if we hear something like I just said, then we somehow consciously or unconsciously interpret that as we're supposed to be established. I need to be established. And what I'm saying is a little different than that. I'm saying, where are you? Because if you think that you're established or pretending to be established or presenting yourself to yourself to be established in something that you're not, then your starting point is not true. It's like trying to follow the directions on a map, but your you are here point is not accurate, you know? And you're following the map perfectly, except that your starting point isn't accurate. And this is, to me, why self-compassion and why self-acceptance is so important on the yogic journey, is because the map only makes sense from our starting point. If I'm starting from where I wish I was, where I think I should be, but where I'm not, I'm going to be following the right map, but from the wrong location. And it won't make sense because it won't be an accurate representation of my circumstance. But it takes tremendous courage and self-honesty and humility to say, I want to be established, but I still would rather eat cake than go to the asana class. But you know what? You can work with that. And that's a starting point, and that to me is so hopeful about the life of practice. So when we talk about practice, sustaining it for the long haul, you know, to anyone listening to this, to me, that's one of the most important things to really honestly evaluate: in what way am I established and in what way am I not? Because different rules apply also at different stages of the game. And this is where some of those masculine encoded sort of prescriptive formulas can work really, really well. For instance, the Baptiste school does this very well. They have the 40 days to a personal revolution or something like that. And then almost every Bikram studio I've ever gone to, they have like, you know, 30-day challenges, or the 12-step communities do 90 meetings in 90 days. And these are protocols to help get us established, where no matter what, you make this a priority and you kind of create these outer structures to do that for you. I have found them incredibly beneficial for structured approaches to practice, for sort of shifting bad habits, but I found it incredibly detrimental to do that to myself over the long haul. You know, over the long haul, I don't want to be doing this to check it off a list or because it's some rote prescription. I want to take practice more like a vitamin rather than like an antibiotic. You know, you don't take antibiotics all the time. You might take a prescription for a period of time. But whereas a vitamin or a good thing to help your constitution. That can be taken every day and it'll just strengthen you. And that to me is a little bit more of a paradigm for practice. So when we talk about practice, that's really good to funnel whatever I say through your own understanding of, well, where are you with that? And so some of us, like myself, you know, like compulsive tendencies, doing something every day isn't always so hard, you know? It's what happens on the days you can't. Are you still okay? And that's the problem with these, you know, hashtag every yoga every damn day, or you have to do it or not, is that, well, what happens when life is the field of practice and you can't make it? Can you still be okay? You know, can you still feel like a yogi if you didn't roll out your mat? Someone was talking to me about this. They were a senior teacher of Mr. Iyengar's, and they were in one of their yearly seminars with him, and there was a local reporter who came in to interview Mr. Iyengar. He asked this question. He asked Mr. Iyengar, what does he do on the days he doesn't want to practice? And everybody's jaw dropped, because it's like a question you would never ask the great master, you know, but this is a reporter who didn't know better and didn't know what question to ask, what not to question. And so the teachers, they said, were all kind of psyched to hear what he would say, because none of them would have, you know, had the nerve to ask it. And he said, well, I do one pose, and sometimes one pose gets me interested in the next pose. Because some days after one pose, it's not coming. And I think he's talking about what's not coming, that feeling of absorption, that feeling of interest, it's not coming. And he goes, and the next day I might do another pose, and if it comes, I go with it, and it might not come, and I do other things. And he goes, but after 5 days, if it doesn't come, then I'll be strict with myself. Mm-hmm. And I thought it was incredible. 5 days he might give himself if it wasn't coming. And you have to know what might be coming for him might not be what's coming for us. You know, and then at some point he was going to be strict again. So he had spaciousness and he had a sense of strictness. And I think those are really good operating, you know, kind of those two wings of the bird, so to speak. Like, okay, you know, we have enough spaciousness with ourselves to allow the process to unfold. Do we have enough boundaries with ourselves to keep us on the path? And my experience has been that yoga always pulls me back. I can get far away and get distracted, but I start to miss that part of me that feels my wholeness. You know, I start to miss the clarity of mind, or the ways that the choice to do formal practice like asana, or to sit on a meditation cushion with regularity, or to do mantra, or to write in a journal, whatever those formal things are that you can check off a list. They have a cascading effect. For instance, if you're going to do hot yoga at 3 p.m, you're going to naturally become more disciplined about lunch. You know, they don't have to tell you not to eat a big lunch. You do yoga in a hot room at 3:30 or 4, you're going to have a light lunch. You know, maybe not the first time, but you're going to learn. You're going to want to be able to get up for meditation. That's going to have to affect your bedtime. And there's these cascading effects that having formal times for practice can start to affect, just like even while we're not watching sometimes. And there's a huge value in that, I think. And there's also good to know, we're also kind of, part of us is probably resistant to that, for as deep as our longing and where's our place in the universe, and I want to know God, and I want God to know me. I also like to pour a glass of wine with some Netflix, you know? We have the part of us that wants consciousness, you know, I think, and that part of us that just doesn't. And it's really good to know that distractions, you know, they're okay. Mm-hmm. Teachers would say a life of distractions not okay. But distractions can be used effectively. We have to have a threshold for all of this work and not turn our lives into something that's sort of like weird and something we don't even want to live in the name of yoga. That seems like a bad deal, you know? It's like, I'm going to be a yogi. I'm going to give up everything and see how long you last without things you love. You know, I think to me the big promise of yoga and why it draws me back is that over time, it's changed what I love. It's changed what I want. So whereas I used to want things like, oh, I just want that next piece of cake, or I want to do whatever I want with no consequences, and I want to go to parties, you know, that's a long time ago, but like I don't want those things anymore. So it's not so much a matter of discipline. It's a matter of wanting something different. And I think that to me is the great promise of, in a sense, those later tantric philosophies, was that it wasn't so much about eradicating desire or trying to turn ourselves into some outer shape of a yogi, but to allow the practices, along with, you know, those times of strictness, but those practices, both masculine and feminine encoded, to change and refine in us what it is that we want. So we start to want the way a wholesome life feels, yeah, more than the thrill of the other things. And we start to shift our, like, maybe center of gravity, and the practice does that. And so it does it, but it doesn't do it if we don't practice. And so that's where the established part happens. It's like there has to be enough of a link that we can loosen up, and enough strictness that we're tethered to something that's real. And I don't think there's a perfect formula. And what does that for you might not do that for me. And what did that for me at 18 when it was like life or death, I found that became quite a big crisis point to practice like my life depended on it. It's like that sort of wasn't a way I could go on. Yeah. But if I didn't take it that seriously initially, I wouldn't have made it either. To me, I know that part of me that doesn't want to practice. You know, sometimes I give it the opportunity to choose. You're like, yeah, let's just not do that today and let's do something else. But I think the other thing is that there's not so much difference. Although, you know, if you don't practice asana, you probably won't get better at asana. But you can get really better at asana and not get better at life. You know? So I know plenty of people, like, they get up for their practice at 6 in the morning. They have to be in bed by 7. They've stopped eating by 6. They don't have any alcohol. They don't have any refined anything. Very puritanical, and they have lovely asana. They're probably really good teachers, too, you know, but they don't have a life that I would want to live, and it might work for them, but that wouldn't be a life that would be worth it to me, as my sensual nature would come calling, you know. So it's different for everybody, and it's different at different times, I think.
Yeah, that resonates a lot with me. I had the experience of doing a Purushottama once, and every day for the 180 days, I was like just literally checking it off. You know, I was like, I'm just going to do it because I said I was going to do it, and I told this person I respect I was going to do it. And then at the end, like the first day that I didn't have to do it, when I sat down to actually do my meditation practice, I literally could say, like, I fell in love with practicing in a way that I'd never experienced before. And it was like having the ability then to like say, oh, this is actually now what I want to do, and it brings me joy, and I like want to wake up in the morning and feel fresh and feel, yeah, lighter mentally and more clear. It was just a huge shift in practice.
And without that prescription and structure, you wouldn't have had the direct experience. It would have been like a dogmatic thing about something you should do to make, you know, it would have been completely different, but the structure gave you the experience, and yeah, the experience informed what it is that you want rather than the outer protocol or the outer should of the prescription. And I think that's just how the practice really does work. You know, it's like it doesn't work unless we do it. At the same time, if we hold it too tight, it becomes its own problem. To me, the practices have that long-term purificatory effect. Not in the same way for everybody, and sometimes we might be growing in one area with a complete blind spot to our narcissistic features and to all of the things that we're not looking at. So I don't think practice is like some big, it's always going to work all the time and help everybody improve in all the ways I might think they need to. But you know, it does, it has these, it's really, they're beneficial things for on so many levels, from the structure they give our lives to the ways that they're working on us that we're not always aware of.
Yeah, absolutely. So, Christina, I know you've been working on a new book. Could you tell us a little bit about it, your intention with it, and who you're hoping it reaches?
Yes, love to. This is the third book that I've written, and they've all been in some ways the same book.
Good start. Go on.
It's a book about moving beyond body image, and as you can tell from some of our talking about my story, that's a big topic for me. For me, body image issues go right alongside what I call food addiction with an eating disorder. So when I wrote the first book, I was really early in my return to yoga with zeal, and it had a big breakthrough with yoga and a workshop I'd gone to with John Friend, and it was a really very cathartic experience. And I'd done so much strong and very fierce, strict kind of yoga. And in 2000, I met John Friend at the time in Anusara Yoga. After meeting Desiree Rumbaugh, I went to his five-day workshop with John Friend. And he was, at the time, Anusara was very new, it was very creative and very potent in its inception stage. And he was talking so much about making your poses an offering, moving from a sense of beauty and love. And it was so not how I did yoga, and so upsetting. It was supposed to be encouraging, you know, and sort of nice. But really the contrast of his encouragement with the way I felt about myself was so critical, and I'd always kind of had a little bit more militant style of yoga and more strict and fierce and teachers. And it was such a dichotomy of seeing this and hearing this out of reflection that this could be an expressive practice of joy and love as opposed to do this right, this is wrong, fix it and make it more perfect. And I really cried for 5 days straight. You know, it was the whole time I'd walk into the workshop, cry, I'd drive home crying, I'd be staying at a friend's house crying. And it was really just the flood of understanding that I had in no way really had a loving relationship with my body from even the way that I was pursuing yoga as a means of recovery wasn't loving. It was still grounded in a kind of what I described in that first book as a war with my body, which I had goes all the way back to really family patterns and sexual abuse and followed up by the drugs, alcohol, bulimia, and the whole thing. So I was new in my relationship with my spiritual teacher at the time. So, the second book kind of went further with that and outlined some philosophy and also talked about my guru's guru, Yogi Ram Sarat Kumar, who was an Indian saint who had built this temple. And so I used this metaphor of temple of the body to talk about how he built this temple that could transmit a kind of spiritual blessing and how practice and our relationship with ourselves through yoga could create within ourselves a kind of sanctuary and a temple that could transmit both to ourselves and in our lives this power of grace. And so now this book, and here I am, the first book I wrote in 2001 was published in 2003, and now this next book will be out in 2019, so we have a big span. And in that time, even a lot of things have happened in yoga. And one of them is that we have social media now. And so when I wrote the first book, there was Yoga International in a print, and there was Yoga Journal, and that was it. And
magazine stands everywhere.
Yeah, right. And there was magazine stands, and there we were barely, you know, getting on. I remember at the beginning of having a yoga studio when I had mine, we didn't have a website. Mm-hmm. We had a phone number. And so I remember my students saying, you need a website. I was like, okay, well, make me one. So I had a website. So, and now you fast forward not that much time. You know, I was like 99. And now we're 2009. That's not that long, where now so much yoga is happening online and the proliferation of images and the media is exacerbating the Western beauty ideal through yoga in a way it was always there, which I wrote about in 2001 in that first book, but it was two print magazines.
Yeah.
You know, one, you know, a little bit more serious, philosophically oriented.
We'll take that.
That's you guys. And that's how I remember it. I remember it being like Yoga International was sort of known as the more serious one, and Yoga Journal was known as the more commercial one. But it was, and then those splits became, I think, even every year, that chasm, as I saw it, widened. At any rate, now it's all happening, so much is happening online. And so when I wrote about body image, I was writing referencing like two main magazines and a handful of marketing materials you might see places. And there was like, you know, the Yoga Journal put out that big coffee table book with big, big black and white pictures of people doing fancy poses. But there wasn't this daily bombardment of images and coupled with the sexualization of yoga that's also gotten increased. So I feel like even though I was talking about body image in 2001, and in my book I had pictures of people in all ages and even different ethnicities pictured, and people related to it in a certain way, now it's this hot topic of body image, and it's got body image coalitions, and it's a huge movement within the world of yoga. And I think some of that has to do with the popularization. We're now a more mainstream endeavor, but I think also the proliferation of images via social media feeds is a completely different world, and that there are so many people who now have not done yoga without it being part of a social interaction online. And for me, yoga was a very solitary thing. We went to a yoga studio. There was no pictures taken. We weren't even allowed to have a notebook in class. And then you went home and practiced, and there was no way to take a picture because the phones weren't digitalized. Occasionally, we'd take pictures at workshops, and we'd get them on film. Like, you'd have to send them away and then put a picture in, like, an envelope and send it to your friend who was at the workshop. I remember this moment. And it was so rare to have a picture in a classroom. And they were real pictures. And now it's just not like that. People get their picture taken in Shavasana. You know, like, no thing is really happening as this private thing. And I'm not ranting that the social media world has done that. It's not my point. Someone could latch onto this conversation and run wild with that. I want to be very clear. Like, that's happening, and there's some good outcomes with that. I'm more saying that we don't have the counterbalance as readily findable, where it is that we do yoga for ourselves only, where we don't in some way market or share it before it's ours. And so I'm not upset that it gets shared. It's more for me my worry that we don't have it for ourselves sometimes before we share it. And the more we have for ourselves before we share, those more things that we integrate and get to know for ourselves before we share it, then when we share, it's going to have more potency, and we won't lose it as much when we share it. In fact, when I have something integrated within myself and I share it, it strengthens the integration. But if I give it away before it's mine, I don't always find it again in the same way. And I subject that thing that's sacred to other people's thought forms and other people's projections, and you end up in a conversation about all that rather than holding on to the sanctity of my own moment. And so that's happened, and I wanted to also just chime in, you know, sort of updated 20 years later on my thoughts on body image and yoga, which are in some ways still the same, which I really do believe that the way yoga helps us with body image is when it taps us into that place of wholeness that I was talking about. I'm a fan of the work of greater representation. I always have been. In my first book, I have picked people of all sizes. I didn't do a good job, in fact, I had with picturing anorexic folks in my book. I had a few people read my book with who had anorexia who were upset anorexics weren't pictured. In this upcoming book, I'm short on a picture of an aging person. But I'm a fan that of representation. You know, I'm a supporter of increasing the images of diversity and beauty, a big cheerleader for any work we can do with that. And I'm also a bit of a critic of it. I think the world would be a better place if we had grown up, most of us, with greater images of beauty and diverse images, even within the yoga world, of who practices yoga. So I do want to say why I'm skeptical, however, is that I don't think it's the complete answer. I think the outer reflections that marketing campaigns offer that we can appeal to in any of those exterior movements, you know, pictures, social media, making sure our studios have a diversity of instructors, both in background, age, abilities, size, so forth. All of that's important. And I don't think that the yoga stops there or should stop there. So my criticism isn't of that, but my cautionary tale is that I think the promise of yoga isn't to help us get better yoga marketing campaigns, to help people feel more included. Although I want people to be included, not just feel included. I want that inclusivity. But I think that really where the healing for me has come from is in those glimpses repeatedly over time that I have this body, but I am more than my body only. And that the yoga's pointing there. And as much as I really do love it to see plus size models in fitness clothes or racially diverse ads for running shoes, I think that's awesome. It's also a marketing campaign. And to confuse marketing campaigns with the freedom that yoga offers, I think, is a mistake. If a company could not make money on a diverse marketing campaign, they probably would not do it. And it's just good to keep a mind on culture. Yeah. Culture is going to conform to culture's demands. And yoga has been a doorway to what's deeper than culture. And it will pass through our culturally conditioned thoughts. And those need refining. We need to look, in my opinion, at the way we're systemically programmed to have racial bias, size bias, ability bias, gender bias. All of that's culturally conditioned, and I think diverse campaigns of marketing help address that and help confront that, and I'm a fan. And then yoga can continue that and take us inward so that we work through those biases inside ourselves. It's not just as a yoga teacher do I say something like larger body versus overweight. Although that's better, that's better languaging, because overweight implies, well, there's a weight that's right and you're over it or you're under it. Instead of, there are larger and smaller bodies, there are rounder bodies and straighter bodies. This is a little bit more objective, and there's probably even better ways to language it that we're learning and uncovering, and people are speaking to with better skill than me. But I'm very interested, and the book is very interested, in the journey that yoga offers us to what's deeper than that. What's deeper than the saying it the right or the wrong way? One thing that's deeper is us understanding what's underneath the images of the body itself. And so this is yet another kind of call to take yoga inward.
Yeah, it's a lot of work.
And it's a lot of work. And to take our own journey inward and, again, grow in our accountability for our own experience a little bit. And also, I really address, for me, it's not just a body image thing. It's really, I had a food addiction in the very same way that an alcoholic would ruin their lives with drinking. The addiction to food functioned for me very much like that. And that's part of the narrative and the body image discussion I haven't heard very much. You know, I had every behavior an alcoholic has, you know, like from going to one drive-through and then to another one, pretending to order food for like four people when it was really just going to be me binging and purging it. And all of these things as part of bulimia and patterns of compulsive overeating. All of those things were part and parcel to the complex of what I was dealing with. It wasn't just that society said thin is good and I didn't look like that. It had much more to do with, coupled with that, was an obsession and a compulsion with and a dysfunctional relationship to food that was linked back to some work I had to do with childhood abuse and with the ways feelings were handled in my family. And all of that just deep psychology work that is never fun to uncover. So there's some of that work in the book, and it's a real appeal to bringing compassion to play in terms of the work, and it does address a little bit of this dark night of the yoga soul. All kinds of things go wrong in our yoga communities. They really do. And sometimes that means we need something is really going wrong, but sometimes it means we have to go deeper.
Thank you so much, Christina, for taking the time to sit here and talk with us. I can't wait for people to hear about your experience and your process, both on and off the mat.
Yay! Thanks, Emily. It's been fun to talk with you.
Thanks.
Thank you all so much for joining us today, and I really hope that you enjoyed the conversation between Christina and Emily. If you have any reflections or questions from this episode, or if you have any suggestions for who you'd like to hear on the next season of Women Seekers and Leaders, please write to us at wsl@yogainternational.com. Until next time, wishing you inspiration and clarity on your own journey toward the truth.